This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with author Robert Goldstein about his recent book, Discrediting the Red Scare, The Cold War Trials of James Kutcher, the Legless Veteran.
Of all the outrageous cases during the post-World War II Red Scare, this was the worst. We talk about President Obama's trip to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, to meet with King Salman. Phyllis Bennis is with the Institute for Policy Studies. She outlines the long relationship between the United States and its key ally, Saudi Arabia, and talks about possible Saudi Arabian involvement in the 9/11 terrorist attacks.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
As we record today's show on May 4th, we recall that it's the 46th anniversary of the murders of Kent State, May 4th, 1970. And then 11 days later, there were more murders and shootings at Jackson State College, which is now Jackson State University, an all-black college located in Mississippi. On May 4th, 1970, students who were opposed to the war in Vietnam held a rally on the campus at Kent State. The National Guard shot into the crowd. Nixon had incited violence by calling anti-war protesters bums. The National Guard killed Alison Krauss, Jeffrey Miller, Sandra Scheuer, and William Schrader. Nine students were also injured. Every year, our colleague and comrade and mentor, William Kunstler, would go to Kent State on May 4th to commemorate the murders and the shootings. Then, 11 days after the May 4th shootings at Kent State, Jackson State came under fire by the police. Two people were killed, Philip Lafayette Gibbs, who was a junior, and a high school senior who happened to be in the dormitory when they opened up fire in the dormitory. A young man named James Earl Green was killed. 12 other people at Jackson State were injured. So we take time today to pause and remember the murders and the shootings at Kent State and at Jackson State. Historian Robert Goldstein has just come out with the book Discrediting the Red Scare, The Cold War Trials of James Kutcher, the Legless Veteran. James Kutcher exposed some of the worst abuses of the Red Scare. His cases got massive publicity and contributed to the Red Scare's demise and the discrediting of the federal loyalty program. Kutcher was a socialist in the 1930s, and he joined a small socialist organization. He was drafted shortly before the American entry into World War II. He fought in North Africa and then Italy, where both of his legs were blown to pieces by a German mortar shell in 1943. After having both his legs amputated and learning to walk with artificial limbs and two canes, Kutcher in 1946 was hired in a menial position at the Veterans Administration as a file clerk with no access to national security information. Nevertheless, as a result of President Truman's March 1947 Federal Loyalty Program, and more specifically due to the listing of Kutcher's organization, the Socialist Workers' Party, on the Attorney General's list of subversive organizations, mischaracterizing it as seeking to violently overthrow the government, Kutcher was fired from his VA position. The government then sought to take away his World War II disability pension and then to evict him and his aged, ill parents from their public housing project in Newark, New Jersey. Goldstein's book tells the dramatic story about a shy and timid person who, with true fortitude, fought for 10 years to establish his and all Americans' constitutional rights to due process, freedom of speech, and freedom of association. Goldstein's book tells the story of a true American hero.
Robert Justin Goldstein, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, glad to be here.
Tell us first, how did you get interested in writing about the Cold War trials of James Kutcher?
I'd be happy to tell you, and I think I'll answer another question that you have in mind in doing so. The last book that I wrote before this current one we're talking about, which is called Discrediting the Red Scare, the Cold War Trials of James Kutcher, the Legless Veteran, and published by University Press of Kansas. So the last book I published, also University Press of Kansas book, it was titled American Blacklist, the Attorney General's List of Subversive Organizations. And it was about a listing that the government began to publish in 1947 as part of the so-called Federal Loyalty Program, which was initiated by President Truman. The Loyalty Program and the Attorney General's List, which was a critical part of implementing it, played a major role in the post-World War II Red Scare. And it dates from 1947. It's really important to know that because Senator McCarthy does not appear on the scene until 1950. So the term McCarthyism is very misleading. The Red Scare was well underway before then. Anyway, the loyalty program of the Truman administration, which was implemented in considerable part to protect the Truman administration against charges that the Democrats were soft on communism, because in 1946 they lost control of both houses of Congress for the first time since 1932 in a campaign in which Republicans made the slogan Americanism versus Communism a major slogan. In the aftermath of that, the Truman administration initiated a program in which the, quote, loyalty of every federal employee from a janitor in the Agriculture Department to the President of the United States was to be investigated. And one of the criteria for determining whether somebody was loyal or not was whether or not they belonged to any organization which the Attorney General of the United States had designated as belonging to one of six categories. One of them was communist, another was subversive, and another was belonging to an organization which sought the violent overthrow of the government. Now, this Attorney General's list was just published as a list. There were no specific charges against any of the organizations. There was no evidence. There were no appeals. It was just published. And in the context of the growing Red Scare, it was like a kiss of death. Well, while writing this book about the Attorney General's list, I ran across many mentions of how a man named James Kutcher, a World War II veteran who had lost his legs during the war to German mortar fire during the American invasion of Italy in 1944, that this James Kutcher, who'd later been hired after the war and after being fitted out with artificial legs, prostheses, he'd been hired as a menial clerk in the Veterans Administration, a job that had no connection with national security at all. But because an organization that he belonged to, the Socialist Workers' Party, SWP, sometimes referred to as a Trotskyite group, which originated as a left-wing split off the American Communist Party, the SWP was listed on the Attorney General's list and specifically was listed as an organization that sought the overthrow of the government.
But let me just interject this, sure. Bob. They were never given due process rights. They never told why they were listed. They were never given a chance to have a hearing. Nobody could speak for them because Kutcher never denied that he was a member. Therefore, he was disloyal. And you pick up the story from from there, if you would, because you write that Kutcher was really an ordinary man in all respects, except that he fought this 10-year battle after he was fired, and you say he was really a hero. And I'd like to ask you why you say that he was a hero.
Okay, well, first of all, Kutcher was, he was just a rank-and-file member of the Socialist Workers Party. Before directly responding to the rest of your question, I just have to mention that Congress, in a prior Red Scare, which that's not really remembered at all in American history, but was very intense, between 1938 and 1941, Congress passed a law which specified that anyone belonging to an organization which sought the overthrow of the government was banned from federal employment. So when the Attorney General listed the SWP, Kutcher's organization, as falling in that category, he had to be fired without any consideration of anything else. But as you say, the SWP and any other group was not given any kind of due process rights of any kind. Well, most people who were subjected to loyalty proceedings, as with Kutcher, sought to keep it very quiet. The so-called loyalty hearings that were held by the federal government, if the FBI uncovered information that suggested they might be disloyal, they were secret. Individuals were not allowed to cross-examine their accusers, who were anonymous to them. They were generally FBI informants, and the FBI did not want to make public the names of their informants. And most people did not want at all publicized that they'd been accused of being disloyal. So the hearings and the procedures were secret, and most people were happy to keep it that way. But Kutcher was very unusual in that he went public about his case, certainly with the encouragement of the Socialist Workers Party, who knew the fact that he had lost his legs fighting for the United States and supposedly fighting for liberty during World War II would make his case one that would attract a lot of publicity. So the fact that he went public, he didn't deny that he was a member of this group, although he denied fervently that the group sought the violent overthrow of the government. The fact that he denied it, and he fought, as you say, for 8 years, actually, by one calculation, even 10 years, he fought repeatedly in administrative bureaucratic hearings that were secret, and he also fought in a number of court cases appealing his loss in these bureaucratic hearings, and the court trials were public. But throughout, Kutcher, with the support of the so-called Kutcher Civil Rights Committee, which was organized by the SWP, unquestionably, he was public all the way, and he said, "I've already lost my legs, and I'm not going to give up my rights."
Yeah, let me read what he wrote them, and then I wanted to talk to you about the defense committee that was organized, because I think that it was a model of how you defend somebody. But in any case, Kutcher wrote to the government that the only time in my life I ever practiced force or violence was under the orders given me in the Army by the U.S. government. And then he goes on to say that the Army did not ask me about my political views or the party to which I belonged when it gave me my Purple Heart. And then he said that it took him a long time to learn how to use his artificial legs, but he did so in order to gain employment because he had to contribute to the support of his aged and sick parents. And then he said, "You understand that it's not too easy to get a job when you have no legs. But 2 years ago this month, I went to work for the Veterans Administration and have filled my job satisfactorily. Now you propose to deprive me of that job solely because of my political views and the party to which I belong. This is a political persecution, and I intend to fight against it with all my vigor because my job is at stake, because a great principle involving my own rights is affected, and because it concerns thousands of other government employees, many of them veterans, whose rights are similarly threatened by this dictatorship procedure. You have the right to disagree with my views, but not to deprive me of my job for holding them, or for belonging to a party and associating with people who share them, or contributing my money to support of a newspaper that defends them. I contend that I have the same right to a government job as any other American, and that not a single shred of real liberty will remain for anyone in this country if I and other political opponents of the government are to be hounded out of our jobs because of the principles we believe in. I have already been deprived of both my legs and my freedom of movement. I do not propose to have any government official deprive me of my freedom of thought and expression and my right to earn a living. The methods employed against me are those of totalitarianism and not of democracy. I thought a really eloquent statement by Kutcher.
Indeed. In addition to his point about never having used violence except under government orders and about never being asked about his political affiliations when he was drafted, he also added that the Germans never asked him before they shot off his legs, and the and U.S. government physicians never asked him about his political views before providing him with artificial legs. I should also add at this point that eventually in 1973, the Socialist Workers Party sued the federal government for harassment and surveillance and won a suit in which the judge declared that the SWP had never engaged in any illegal acts, had not only not advocated the overthrow of the government, but had actually expelled members who were viewed as advocating violence. So throughout this whole period, in which the only charges against Kutcher were that he was a member of the SWP, that he contributed money to the SWP, and that he attended and participated in ordinary SWP activities, those were the only charges. And eventually, this federal court ruling in the 1970s found that, you know, there was no basis really for listing the SWP on the Attorney General's list, which was ultimately the cause of all his troubles.
Can you talk a bit about the Kutcher Civil Rights Committee, their purpose, principles, and specifically what they did?
Yeah, pretty clearly, this was an organization created by the SWP to support Kutcher. They made clear that they welcome all people and organizations to support them, and that support of Kutcher and his rights in this case didn't imply that people who wanted to give their support to Kutcher agreed with any of his political opinions necessarily or with the SWP's. So they tried to build a very broad coalition at their height, and, you know, I can't vouch for the exactitude of some of the claims, but at their height they claimed the support of 1,000 different organizations with a combined membership of 5 million. There certainly were many, many organizations that voiced their support, particularly CIO unions, including many state CIO councils and many city CIO councils, as well as lots of individual unions. And there was also support voiced by a wide variety of other organizations, including a group called the American Veterans Committee. The American Civil Liberties Union supported Kutcher with Friends of the Court briefs, although they tried to avoid being too closely identified with anything that could be viewed as communist during this period. I should mention the SWP was vehemently anti-Russian and anti-Stalinist, although they did describe themselves as communist. And also there was support from many prominent individuals, including many prominent professors at the University of Chicago.
Yeah,
and
60 professors at Harvard. Edmund Wilson, the preeminent literary critic, Norman Mailer, the author, right, one of the great African-American leaders, A. Philip Randolph, got tremendous support. I was interested in what Joe Rao, his attorney who took the case pro bono, and Rao said it was really the worst case in the witch hunt. And he said, and the lowest moment of all was when the government tried to take away Kutcher's disability pension. Now, remember, they took away his job. They tried to kick him out of public housing. And now they were going to take away the $300 and some a month that he and his parents were living on that he got because he lost his legs. And they tried to take away his disability pension. It was really the most cruel thing one could imagine that a government would do to a disabled veteran. But let me ask you this. The FBI was very active in monitoring Kutcher during the course of all of this. And the head of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, was up to the minute on all of this. Why do you think that is?
Well, Hoover and the FBI basically viewed the SWP as a communist organization, which, in fact, they described themselves as. Although they, as I said before, they were very anti-Russian and anti-Stalinist. They described Russia as a degenerate workers' state or something like that. And the SWP and the Communist Party were at each other's throats a great deal. But to Hoover, it was a communist group, and that was enough for him. The FBI, of course, during this period, was engaged in surveillance of all sorts of groups that were, you know, not extremely respectable, shall we say, in terms of the mainstream, and also surveilled all sorts of prominent Americans. While doing some research for the American Blacklist list, I came across a long memo from Hoover, a confidential memo from Hoover to President Eisenhower that basically suggested that Jonas Salk was a communist. They kept Albert Einstein under intense surveillance, and the great Negro actor and singer Paul Robeson, W.E.B. Du Bois, Arthur Miller, Pete Seeger, Harry Belafonte, all sorts of prominent people who in any way indicated sympathy for the political left were kept under surveillance. So the SWP was an easy choice for the FBI, given what they were doing.
I thought that Kutcher's position on violence and on majority rule is something that we should emphasize, because he always denied that he was supportive of violence. And what he said was, quote, "The working class, that although we don't advocate violence, it's not wrong to protect yourself against violence if it is used by the minority to protect the carrying out of the majority decision." And that kind of formulation, I think, really mirrors how historically these things evolve. And the government, nonetheless, kept trying to say he was for violence, even though he said, "I'm only for violence if the majority will is disavowed and the minority tries to attack us, we can defend ourselves." But I wanted to ask you, Kutcher's victories were really complete. He won and got his job back. And then he got his pension. And then he got back pay. And then he was able to keep his home in Newark. One after the other. What did the FBI do even after Kutcher won all these victories? Did they still spy on him?
Yeah, absolutely. Kutcher remained a member of the SWP through all this period, and the FBI kept the SWP and Kutcher as a member under intense surveillance. So, as you say, he won all three of these fights. He won his job back after 8 years of struggle and many, many administrative hearings and about five different federal district court and federal appeals court decisions. He won against an attempt of the Veterans Administration, as you said, to take away his World War II disability pension, which actually was kind of the height of the public attention to Kutcher, which attracted lots of press attention. It became known as the case of the legless veteran. And there was actually a huge public uproar over this attempt, which came at Christmas time of 1955, if I recall the year exactly. Enormous press attention and condemnation, and the VA quite unusually opened to the press its hearing on the disability pension question, and came out looking very, very badly. At one point, the chairman of the Veteran Administration Board said that, you know, there were no procedures and that he would make them up as they went along, which Rao sort of got out of him, because Rao kept asking, what are the rules for this hearing? And eventually basically said, well, I'll just make them up.
Yeah, Rao said after the guy said that, it was like taking candy from a baby. We're talking to Professor Robert Justin Goldstein, who's recently had published the book Discrediting the Red Scare, The Cold War Trials of James Cutcher, the Legless Veteran. The book is published by the University Press in Kansas, and it's part of their landmark law cases in American society. Really a worthwhile contribution that you've made, Bob, discrediting the Red Scare. We're coming to the end of our allotted time here, but let me ask you this. What do you think is relevant about the Kutcher case today, the principles that it established and the way it was fought by his defense committee? Is that something that we should know about today in terms of the struggles that are going on now?
Well, certainly. Again and again in American history, we've been in situations where during periods of national security concerns, the government has engaged in a lot of abuses in trying to surveil and control, repress, discredit, disrupt dissent. It happened in the United States during World War I when there was intense repression that basically has vanished from the collective memory. Many people know about the post-World War I Red Scare, the so-called Palmer Raids, when 5,000 to 10,000 people were arrested across the country in a single night for the purpose of deportation, and eventually only 500 were deported, and none of them for committing violence, but all for their affiliations. There were abuses in the 38-41 Red Scare that I mentioned, and of course during the so-called McCarthyism post-World War II Red Scare, and of course we don't really know everything that's occurring now, except we keep finding out through leaks that the government surveillance has far exceeded that of targeting individuals about whom the government has reason to believe are engaged in terrorism. The government's been involved in massive sweeps of telephone call records and apparently internet records of all kinds, and you know, lots of other things that we keep learning about. So our history has taught us that time after time during these national security crises or perceived crises, the government ends up committing a lot of abuses, and then years later, there's a lot of regrets. Of course, I didn't mention the Japanese-American internments solely for their Japanese-American background during World War II, which 30 years later, Congress actually formally apologized for and offered compensation to those who are still living. So
the leading Republican contender wants to deport Mexicans and prevent Muslims from coming into the country. So it's same sort of stuff. We've been talking to Professor Robert Justin Goldstein, who's written an excellent book called Discrediting the Red Scare, The Cold War Trials of James Cutcher, The Legless Veteran. Bob, you've really resurrected the story of a true hero whose fight, more than any other case, I think your book demonstrates, served to discredit the list of subversive organizations and the Red Scare and mobilize Democratic-minded Americans to come to the support of this man. Just a tremendous hero to me, and I'm so grateful to you for doing the hard work and getting the documents from the FBI and the legal papers and going through them and all, and putting this story together for us. You really resurrected a hidden history and an important one, and we're so happy to have you on Law and Disorder, Bob. Thank you so much.
Okay, well, thanks for your kind words, and I'd be glad to be on your show. Tell everyone to buy 10 copies each.
You take it easy.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
just a bubble. The loving and the art for falling, it's just a bubble.
Phyllis Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and she's written several books on the Middle East. She joins us today to talk about the alleged Saudi Arabian connection to 9/11 and Obama's meeting with the Saudi Arabian king. The United States Congress is presently considering a bill to lift the sovereign immunity Saudi Arabia enjoys, which protects the Saudi Arabian government from the pending lawsuits for wrongful death brought by the families of the 9/11 victims. Legislation to do this is backed by both Republicans and Democrats and opposed by the Obama administration. The Saudi Arabian government has threatened, some have called it blackmail, to dispose of the $750 billion in American assets, including treasury bonds, that it owns to protect itself if its sovereign immunity is lifted. Saudi Arabia is, along with Israel, America's key ally in the Middle East. Phyllis Bennis, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you, Michael.
Phyllis, how did Saudi Arabia become a key American ally in the Middle East? And what do you think the two countries do for each other?
Well, it goes back to, actually, it goes way back to the discovery of oil in Saudi Arabia in the early part of the 20th century. But it was kind of consolidated in the 30s. Saudi Arabia became independent in 1932. The next year, they give their first oil concessions to Standard Oil of California, which created something called Saudi Aramco, meaning America Arabian Company, completely controlled by the U.S. that was in charge of Saudi oil. And the deal was, it was a kind of a quid pro quo. We'll give you all the oil you want and control of our oil in terms of how it's produced and how the pipelines work and where they go and all that stuff. And in return, you'll provide us with military and strategic protection. So that gets consolidated again right after World War II, 1945. FDR goes and meets with the Saudi king, actually on a ship outside the Suez Canal, and they pledge support to each other. And the quid pro quo at that point was defined in the context more or less as oil for anti-communism. You know, you give us oil, we'll give you protection in the context of this rising anti-communist, anti-Soviet U.S. role in the world. And then in the context of the Truman Doctrine in 1947, you have the containment of communism is now U.S. policy, and U.S. economic aid is expanded, especially to Greece and Turkey, but also to Saudi Arabia. And then by the time of the Nixon Doctrine in 1969, Vietnamization is on the table, the nuclear umbrella, and the idea there is local proxies will do the work of fighting U.S. wars against the Soviet Union, so the U.S. doesn't have to directly. So in the context of the Middle East, that's Iran and Saudi Arabia. Iran under the Shah, the U.S.-backed Shah, and Saudi Arabia under the U.S.-backed king. So the two of them are two of the three pillars of U.S. strategic allies in the region, the third being Israel. And that relationship, you know, obviously it changes with Iran after the Iranian Revolution of 1979, but the relationship with Saudi Arabia remains. And then you see in the period of the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan, the alliance with the Saudis plays a very important role. So all of this goes on, you know, the nationalization of Saudi Aramco in 1980, where the kingdom essentially bought back control of their own oil. And in response to that, among other things, the Carter Doctrine emerges that created what became central command of the Pentagon and essentially asserted that the oil of the Persian Gulf was our oil, belonged to us, and that anybody who threatened it, meaning mainly the Soviet Union, but potentially Iran, potentially anybody else, would be subject to the use of force. So you have this triplet of alliances between the U.S. and its regional partners, Israel, Iran, and Saudi Arabia. And then after the Iranian Revolution, when the U.S.-Iran link breaks, the Saudi-Iran tensions start to emerge, and the competition starts to take hold in that part of the world. So this whole question of the U.S. relationship to Saudi Arabia goes way, way back to anti-Sovietism, to anti-communism, but these days it's gone even beyond oil, which is less of an issue for the U.S. in terms of access, for sure, because the U.S. isn't importing nearly as much oil as it used to, but it's really all about arms sales. So now the whole question of the arms industry having this incredible dependence on arms sales to Saudi Arabia, who's by far the biggest purchaser of U.S. arms of anybody in the world. You know, 5 years ago, there was the biggest arms deal in history, in the whole history of the world. Biggest arms deal was a $60 billion arms deal negotiated by the Saudis.
Well, let me stop you here and ask you, what kind of regime is United States selling all these weapons to? They've got a new king. His 30-year-old son is the defense minister. It's the kind of government that beheads people for sorcery. Talk to us about the nature of the Saudi internal regime.
Yeah, this is a really horrific regime. This is an absolute monarchy without even any pretense of democratization. This is a regime that grew out of the largely nomadic populations of the Arabian Peninsula. What is now Saudi Arabia, of course, you know, this was all in the context of the Ottoman Empire for 400 years. This was part of the Ottoman Empire. It was Arabia. There were no nation states. Saudi Arabia didn't exist. Jordan didn't exist. None of these independent countries existed at that time. They were part of a broader region within an empire. And after World War I, when countries were sort of created, mainly by the British and the French, and they imposed kings on them, mainly what they did was bring a king from one area and put him in power in another area so there wouldn't be a danger of local support that might diminish the dependence of this new king on his, and it was always a his, on his imperial backers. So, you know, you have the House of Saud, that was the king that emerged in what's now Saudi Arabia. And they came to power building an alliance with the most conservative parts of the clergy, of the Islamic clergy of the time. And so from the very beginning of the emergence of Saudi Arabia as a country, their vision of Islam, which is known as Wahhabism, it's by far the most conservative sect or kind of interpretation of Islam, has been inherently connected to the governance. So there's no illusion about a division between church and state. This is a church or mosque-run state, and the laws of Wahhabi-style Islam govern the kingdom day-to-day. So one of the other crimes, you mentioned, you know, people being beheaded for sorcery, one of the other crimes is apostasy, the idea that a Muslim gives up his or her religion and takes up Judaism or Christianity or atheism or whatever. That's also a capital crime in Saudi Arabia. This is a regime which doesn't, again, even pretend to encourage equality between men and women. There are no rights for women. Women, you know, what we hear about is, oh, women can't drive, which, frankly, is the least of the problem women face in Saudi Arabia. Women are not allowed to travel, to have a job, to go to school, to go to the doctor without the permission of a male guardian who, for children, is their father. When they get married, it's their husband. A single woman is obligated to get the permission of her father or her brother if her father is dead. If she doesn't have a brother, it can be an uncle. It's a horrific infantilization at best and an excuse for massive abuse at worst of women by law. This isn't, you know, we're not talking about men operating outside the law. We're talking about implementation of the law. So this is a horrific country from the vantage point of human rights. And when you expand that to the non-citizen workforce, because a very large percentage of the Saudi population is made up of guest workers, if you will, that are brought in from all over the world. It tends to be Egyptians in sort of mid-level clerical and administrative positions. A lot of the doctors, lawyers, professionals tend to be Palestinians. There's a whole range. And then at the lower levels of the economic structures, people who clean the streets, people who take care of domestic workers, are brought in from much poorer countries, from the Philippines, from India, a lot from South Asia, from Pakistan. And these are people who have no rights. So it's a very, very grim, very repressive, and very controlled society that we're talking about, that the U.S. continuously identifies as our best friend in the Arab world.
Well, yeah, speaking of best friends, let's talk about the 14 of the 19 terrorist hijackers, 9/11, were Saudi Arabians.
Right.
And what is being said about the role of elements in the Saudi Arabian monarchy or government? What role might they have played in the 9/11 attacks?
Well, there's a lot of evidence, some of which came out in a recent 60 Minutes episode a couple of weeks ago that got a great deal of attention. The fact that members of Congress, including Bob Graham, are discussing this now. What appears, there's very little clarity about at what level of the government, whether it's the kingdom, a rogue prince somewhere, some low-level officials, but there's very little doubt that there was Saudi support in some ways for these Saudi hijackers. Whether there was also support for the Egyptians among them is not so clear, but at least for the Saudis, there are indications, this came out in the 60 Minutes show, among others, that a fairly low-ranking diplomat at the Saudi consulate in Los Angeles was involved in helping to provide for an apartment, some money, access to a job, when at least a couple of the hijackers arrived in the U.S. Apparently their English skills were not very good. And there were claims that it was sort of a coincidence. He happened to meet them at a restaurant. A lot of very, let's say, not confirmed stories, to put the best possible face on it. But there's really no question that, at least on some level, Saudi officials, and more likely at a larger scale, other Saudis who may or may not have had a direct connection to the government, may have been wealthy individuals, may have been tied to one or another of these religious institutions that have been sent around the world to expand the influence of the Saudi version of Islam, of Wahhabi Islam. So there's a lot of opaque information. The indications are the so-called 28 pages, the redacted piece of the 9/11 report that's never been allowed to go public. The reports of people who have read it, who of course can't go public and say exactly what it said, because they have to sign an oath that they won't do that. But it sounds like there's a lot of smoke and not much certainty in those pages about some role that the Saudis, including parts of the Saudi government, played in making the 9/11 attacks possible.
That's what Senator Bob Graham told us at Law and Disorder when we interviewed him 2 months ago. He said that there were elements of the Saudi Arabian monarchy or the government, and he said that's really one and the same thing.
And he was one of the people that can't directly comment on the 28 pages because he was the senator in charge of the Intelligence Committee in the Senate who looked into it. But he did write a novel, which I read, and he was advised to do it in fictional form, and the novel indicates that it were elements in the monarchy and or the government that did it. So I imagine that that's one of the topics that Obama discussed with King Salman on his visit last week. You know, in New York, one of our major newspapers, the New York Daily News, last week had a headline that called the Saudi Arabian government scum, in quote. The story went on to say that the Saudis have been, quote, blackmailing the U.S., that they've threatened to unload $750 billion that they own in U.S. assets, lots of treasury bonds, if the United States Congress takes away their immunity from wrongful death lawsuits brought by the surviving families of people killed at the World Trade Center on 9/11.
Right.
Why has the Obama administration, you know, the State Department, the Treasury Department, opposed lifting that immunity?
Well, it's a very interesting divide right now between Congress and the administration, and there are some indications even within the administration there's a big divide. What we're looking at here, it's very interesting. There was a report this morning that the Saudi government has said it has no objections to the 28 pages being made public. Their objection and their threat to, which I think is not a realistic threat, I don't think they could actually unload $750 billion in U.S. bonds without destroying their own economy because it would be sold at such a low price. So I think that's bluster. But there's no question that they are very, very afraid of any kind of precedent that would allow them to get into a U.S. court. Whether they ultimately were held liable or not, they don't want to be in that position of having to defend their monarchy, their practices in the public eye in the United States. That's really what this is about. If the report this morning is accurate, and I have no reason to think it isn't, that they're fine with agreeing that the 28 pages can be made public, it does confirm what has been the indication from people who have read the report that there's nothing in it that is actionable, if you will, in a legal sense, that there's no smoking gun, that there are hints, there may be some circumstantial evidence. But by itself, the 28-page document is not going to be enough to convict the Saudi regime of direct or in fact, even indirect involvement in the 9/11 attacks. Their concern is less, I think, about that piece of evidence, because I think they must know what's there and what isn't, as much as it is the question of their immunity as a sovereign government. I think for the Obama administration, there's also the issue of its own sovereign immunity in courts, the sovereign immunity of the United States government around the question of not only the 9/11 cases, but in general, in terrorism cases. If, for example, somebody wanted to bring a lawsuit that said that a terrorist attack, whether it was Paris or San Bernardino or any other, Istanbul, was caused in response to XYZ U.S. policy, for instance. I don't happen to think that's probably a winning case in the U.S. courts, but getting that issue into a U.S. court in a public venue would be hugely important to be able to put these debates out in the public arena. And I think that no U.S. administration wants to see that happen. So they are concerned about the precedent. They're also concerned about the Saudi threat, of the financial threat, I'm sure, which is, as I say, I think it's a bluster, but probably not entirely a bluster. They probably could do some damage through their massive U.S. multi-billion-dollar holdings. But it's also about the U.S. deals with the Saudis. The U.S. still relies on Saudi Arabia as a major proxy in the region. So the wars that are being fought in Syria today, there's 8, 9, 10 separate wars underway, and the U.S. and the Saudis are mostly on the same side, ironically enough.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, because I wanted to get into the role of the Saudi Arabian government vis-a-vis ISIS and the
declining power of the Saudis vis-a-vis Iran with respect to the United States, and also right. the war that they're conducting in Yemen. So ISIS,
yeah,
Iran,
the
Yemen.
The military role of Saudi Arabia in the region right now is overwhelmingly horrible and overwhelmingly powerful, largely made possible by our weapons. That's kind of the short version. The specifics on the question of ISIS, in my new book on ISIS, and the key thing here is, again, in some ways like their role in 9/11, there's not a lot of clarity about who in the Saudi regime, specific princes, the king, this or that institution, wealthy Saudi bankers, not very much clarity about where in Saudi Arabia directly it's coming from, but there's no doubt that large sums of money are routinely being passed from Saudi Arabia to ISIS. And the key thing is, what I think is so important, Michael, is that even if we don't know exactly whether it's in regard to ISIS or in regard to 9/11, even if we don't know exactly who in Saudi Arabia is funding these terrorist elements, what we do know is that this is a government that is tightly controlled enough that if it chose, whether it was within the regime or outside the regime, if it chose, it could stop that practice. That's what's key. Well, and it's choosing not to do that. On the question of Iran, I referenced this a little bit earlier, that the challenge between Iran and Saudi Arabia, the competition between them, is partly strategic over oil, over who's going to be the regional hegemon. It also reflects a religious sectarian competition between Sunni and Shia Islam. So there's, you know, a host of issues that divide those two countries, which as long as one side is being continuously armed to the teeth by the United States, it makes it very difficult to, as President Obama did last week, call on the two sides to sort of tamp it down, develop some kind of a cold peace. You know, that's very hard when you're sending all the weapons in the world to one side.
Really?
And then finally, the use of U.S. weapons in Yemen has led to a massive humanitarian disaster, where we now have 80% of the entire population of the country completely dependent on U.N. Food aid for basic survival. There have been something like over 3,000 people killed, almost all civilians, through these bombing raids that are carried out by the Saudi Air Force flying U.S. planes, dropping U.S. bombs, and provided with in-air refueling by U.S. pilots that are flying these refueling planes. So the U.S. is directly involved in this war. We're also providing targeting information. So it's one of these situations where we can say all we want, this is the Saudis' war and we wish they would stop it, but this is also Washington's war. This is the Pentagon's war. And it's not surprising that people across the region are holding the United States accountable for the massive destruction that this war has left in Yemen.
Well, thank you so much, Phyllis Bennis. Before we say goodbye, please remind our audience of the name of your newest book on ISIS.
It's called Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, a primer.
Thank you so much, Phyllis Bennis, for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure.
Take it easy.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Dominican.